Hi, everybody. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about an hour. About 1 hour. Our first movie, our good one, is Black Narcissus, directed by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. And 1947, our bad movie is Cobra, directed by George P. Cosmatos and released in 86. So let's start with Black Narcissus. I'm kind of embarrassed to say that this is the first Michael Powell movie that I've seen. Powell and Pressburger, they were kind of a directing team, which is definitely odd. I always heard about Michael Powell's 1960 horror movie Peeping Tom about the psychotic cameraman, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that now, because even though it's just him, I mean, him and Pressburger are such visually kind of striking directors, and Black Narcissus almost turns into a horror movie at the end. It's almost like Suspiria or something towards the end. And I can imagine a Michael Powell horror movie scaring the crap out of me. But you know, as a melodrama, this was really cool. And the plot's really, I remember before seeing it, you said something like it's just a collection of like strong images and stuff. And it was definitely very episodic, and finding out that it was based on a novel didn't surprise me. Although it's all the little subplots and stuff don't really seem to add up to anything. And the way that this convent of nuns in the Himalayas, the way that we follow Deborah Carr as the nun who's the head nun in charge, the way she kind of loses her grip on what's going on and managing the place. I don't know if it isn't gradual or if it's so gradual that I didn't even notice it was happening. But I mean, if there's a plot, it's sort of about how these isolated, seemingly isolated, well, they are isolated incidents kind of, turn the screws and put the strain on the nuns. And, It's just that like the high peak of drama at the very end, where one of the nuns, who was it?
What is her name? Yeah. Not Flora Robeson.
Kathleen Byron, as Sister Ruth. Sister Ruth basically goes nuts. And that just kind of comes out of nowhere. But I think we're meant to, when she's going nuts, she says basically that she's going nuts because of the same things that have been affecting Deborah Carr, which are mainly this guy played by David Farrar, who's the agent. He's a Brit. He's a fellow Brit like they are. He's an agent of this old general who lives down the mountain. He's a British Raj, and he's not a Raj, he's just a general. He's like the one, you know, a British man in the area, and so he's kind of the object of all this unspoken lust and flirtation and stuff. And it's kind of like Deborah Carr has this unspoken, you know, romance with him that doesn't go anywhere, and it's basically based off of him being a dick and her, you know, being able to tame him. So when Kathleen Byron kind of goes nuts and she confesses that she's been falling in love with him, it kind of seems out of nowhere. I mean, there's like the one scene where Deborah Carr has just finished talking to him and she sees a nun running off, and because, you know, all the nuns are dressed alike, you can't really tell who it was. And I guess like she was kind of scurrying around in the background before that's kind of leading up to it. But It's basically that, and the other thing that makes her go nuts but isn't really built up gradually is I don't quite actually know, because it's like the symptoms of her illness that start to show up in the second half of the movie are like she plants flowers where she should be planting crops of food.
Oh, that's not her. That's the other one. That's the...
Oh, my mistake. Yeah. All right, well, okay, well, you know, it's like pressure. Yeah, the pressure is kind of happening to all these nuns, and the only kind of explanation is this really amorphous thing of, like, also late in the movie, like, when Dave Farrar is saying to Deborah Kerr, like, you know, you're going to be leaving pretty soon. At the beginning, when they show up, he says, you know, you'll never last. And it's kind of like, huh, what, why not? You know, what's so bad about, you know, opening a convent high up in the Himalayas, you know, except for the fact that it's isolated. It's not like The Shining or anything. Like, they're teaching children, you know, they've got plenty of stuff to occupy them. But towards the end, Dave Farrar says to Deborah Kerr, like, there's something about, you know, just being up high at this altitude in the atmosphere here. It makes, it heightens everything, or it exaggerates everything.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was almost a Paolo Pressburger making a comment about their own movie. Like, every little thing is very, very heightened and exaggerated. So it would be enough to drive someone mad, the little things, I guess. Like the fact that there's a wise man down the hill who never talks to anyone. Like, somehow that's just one more thing that kind of gets under the nun's skin because they can't control it, you know?
I think that some of it also is that the nuns are used to an enclosed setting, and they're sort of at the top of the world. And
thought of that. Yeah, because they also talk about, like, how intense it is having these giant mountainous, you know, vistas all around them.
And having...
Which are these amazing, like, painted on glass matte paintings.
Okay, so you did know that it was filmed entirely on set, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can tell they're matte paintings. It's just, you know, they're beautiful. It looks like human beings walking through paintings.
Yeah, it's, that's always, I don't think I knew that the first time I watched it, necessarily, that I mean, I knew some of it had to be matte paintings, but just the degree that they are able to do this and the lighting.
It's filmed in Pinewood, just like Batman.
Yeah, just like Batman, but it was... I don't think Batman shot...
Batman had a lot of matte paintings, but it didn't have this many matte paintings.
It also didn't have this cinematographer. I think that... Right.
Yeah,
I'm not sure anybody's ever quite lit interior daylit scenes as well, that are supposed to be exteriors, as well as Cardiff does on this one. I mean, it's just incredible the stuff that he can get away with, and what they kind of are able to use him for. I mean, it's just kind of, because I mean, this was 46 or 47, so color cinematography was not in its infancy, but it was certainly nowhere near... This doesn't look anything like, say, Gone with the Wind, or... Yeah. Trying to think. There were some U.S. war movies that were in color at this time, I think. I mean, it's nothing like that. It's just so striking, and... It's actually the first time I ever saw clips of this. This wasn't my first Powell and Pressburger movie, but the first time I saw clips of this was in, I think, this documentary called Visions of Light, something like that. That's just a big documentary about the cinematography over the years. And this was, of course, their big early color cinematography example. But the stories... I forgot. I remembered some of it because I saw it a few years ago, and then I forgot other parts of it. But it's just so gradual, and nothing really gets...
It looks like a sitcom at some point. The convent up in the Himalayas and all the wacky characters, like May Hallett, the kind of... There's only one Indian actor in the movie, Sabu, and he plays, you know, the Thief of Baghdad and some other 40s movies. He was like the Indian actor for American movies in the 40s and British movies. But everyone else, like, who's supposed to be Indian, like, when I started watching, I wasn't really sure if, like, May Hallett as the kind of crone, like, crotchety... Yeah. Crotchety old lady who's a handmaiden of the old general. She's kind of hilariously awful. Like at the end when the sister has gone nuts and the other nuns are running around the convent yelling, "Sister Ruth, Sister Ruth," May Hallett mocks them. "It's Sister Ruth," and she's such a there's something about her, the fact that she's a British lady playing an old Indian woman, her crotchety old voice actually made me think, like, who is this actress? I know I've seen her in other stuff, and I was trying to think, you know, in my mind, like, what lines of dialogue I might have heard from that same crotchety old lady voice, and then I realized I was thinking of, like, the old ladies on Fawlty Towers. Old British lady voice that old British Pepper Pot ladies seem to have. And May Hallett, like, has not been in anything else that I've ever seen. So it's just that kind of familiarity. Oh, and then Gene Simmons plays a lovely Indian girl who seduces Sabu. And she, she's obviously, you know, Gene Simmons with the makeup on. But May Hallett, the old lady, I took me a while to realize she was supposed to be Indian because she even sounds British. I mean, Gene Simmons doesn't talk, so she doesn't have that hand.
Yeah, Gene Simmons doesn't have a single line.
She doesn't have a single line of dialogue, so she doesn't have that to have to fake or anything. But, oh, the guy who plays the old general, the old Indian general, he's pretty... it's kind of vaudevillian almost. It's definitely just a British actor playing an Indian.
And then, so it's actually not that long of a movie. I mean, it's only 100 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And I think that the sort of not going overboard with it is because it opens in the convent in, somewhere in India, big
in the,
city.
In the Himalayas. Yeah, yeah.
And then it opens up into this, you know, they get the letter and they're going to go there. And it's almost like there's this Dirty Dozen scene where they're picking the nuns who are going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the scene where Sister Ruth, you see all the other nuns that are picked to go, but you don't see Sister Ruth. She's not at the table. And then when you get introduced to her, and it's kind of... Kathleen Byron is sort of playing this hideously evil nun.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
they get some really scary shots of her throughout the movie. With an evil glint in her eyes and a really disturbing evil grin.
And it's kind of like she really pulls it off really well. Because, I mean, she's like pretty, but damn if she's not just like psychotically evil. I mean, some of those shots at the end... Yeah. You could see her holding a bloody axe and like murdering children.
I think they even put pale makeup on her at one point towards the end to make her look kind of, you know, ghostly. I mean, she did pass out earlier, but this amazing thing happens when she, you see her in the nun's outfit throughout the whole film. And, Deborah Carr is the only other nun who you see not as a nun because she has some flashback scenes to her pre-sisterhood life. But when Kathleen Byron isn't a nun anymore, it's this shocking revelatory scene where Deborah Carr busts into her room and Kathleen Byron has changed into a dress. And suddenly you're like, wow, she's actually a good-looking lady, evil as she is. And it's this intense, like, you know, they're staring at each other and there's a swell of music. And it's almost like Deborah Carr has walked in on her with a, in the middle of a murder scene or something. Like she's just committed this shocking crime by changing out of her her nun's clothing because of what it means of abandoning the convent and everything. And then the next scene is her. Well, a few scenes later, she tries to seduce Dave Farrar, and he won't have any of it.
And that scene is where it brings up that I'm trying to think what the most obvious thing in the movie is, just because so much hinges on this relationship between the love triangle that is a love triangle that's never acknowledged.
Right, and Deborah Carr isn't even aware that it's
right. I mean, she's, you know, it's, they're kind of flirting, and she softens, basically, is what happens. It's kind of when he comes along and he gets approached by Kathleen Byron, and he's just totally enraged at the idea that he's being
it's funny because it's like he's not really flirting with Deborah Carr. I mean, he's not after her. He just gives her a hard time whenever he comes up.
Yeah, like, he's kind of a
taboo.
Yeah, he's just a dick.
Right, and Deborah Carr might have a little bit of an attraction to him at first, but I mean, it's sort of clear, like, at some point she just loses her patience with him. And while this is going on between them, it's like Kathleen Byron is... You don't even see her as it's happening to her, but she's watching this and thinking that Deborah Carr is trying to steal him away, you know, because there's a scene where she confronts, the two of them have this confrontation. Deborah Carr is going to send her back, and Kathleen Byron is basically like, you know, you just want to keep the guy to yourself. And Deborah Carr is like, huh? What? Is that what this is about to you? You know?
And so...
It's extremely peculiar love triangle.
And the other strange thing about it is nun movies.
Yeah, they're not exactly a genre with established rules or cliches.
Yeah, so it's kind of, I mean, it's very interesting because you have this, you know, these strong female characters, and they're sort of, it's never defined what the rules are. Like, they don't want David Farrar around at the beginning. He's not allowed to be around at the beginning because he's just some dude.
Mm-hmm.
He's also sort of the equivalent of if you've ever seen one of those movies set in the West Indies, like on Tahiti or something. There's always
I've seen I Walked with a Zombie.
Was there a guy in there that, I don't know if there was one and I Walked with a Zombie, but in those movies, there's always some guy who's like some British drunk or an American drunk who's basically just shacking up with the young native girls. That's what David Farrar is here.
Right.
And he's sort of...
It's strongly implied that he shacked up with Gene Simmons.
And he's trying to get... He gets rid of her at the convent, and he even tries to get Deborah Kerr to ask him about it, which is just this really uncomfortable scene. And it's like the way he's so mean-spirited, but with a smile on his face, and he says some awful stuff to her that, I mean, I would imagine would really upset a nun. Right. And it's just kind of like... So that's sort of what he's doing there. And then they form this relationship of dependence because they can't get a plumber. Apparently, in the nun rules, apparently, and plumber is allowed there, but not him in his shorty shorts. And, I mean, he shows up in shorty shorts. He shows up with his shirt off a couple times. And it's just kind of like you have to – sort of view him from the nun's perspective, which the movie doesn't really set you up to do. But if you were to view it without thinking of him from the nun's perspective and how he's interacting with them, you probably wouldn't understand what's going on. And so when they do, he and Carr eventually do form this like sort of bond over, well, it's kind of as a result of the, what happens is the convent, it's introduced in like the first scene. You can't, basically, they can't be responsible for killing anybody. They have to be very careful not to kill any natives. Or to even treat very ill natives, because the natives might take their failure to cure the sick person as killing them. And so, long story short, the non-medically trained nun who likes kids ends up giving castor oil to a woman whose baby dies. And so everybody hates the nuns for a second. And so they sort of have to call on David Farr. And so he and Deborah Kerr have that scene where that you mentioned earlier, where they talk about the air up there and things like that. And at this point we realize, well, at this point we've seen that she's gone through sort of this similar transformation that the gardening nun goes through, where she wants to make the convent, or it's not really a convent, well, I get whatever, it's called the Palace of Women, because that's the other thing, the other reason it's totally inappropriate for them to be there, is it used to be the harem for the previous general.
There's illustrations of naked women on the walls all over the place.
Yeah, and so the only one who doesn't sort of go nuts is actually the medical nurse. We never see any sign that she is reacting to her surroundings the way everyone else is. Because the one nurse who likes the kids so much, the one nun who likes the kids so much, she's reacting to this setting that is so
intense.
But it's intense, but it's like,
I guess, you know, maybe the reason that the craziness sort of seemed to have come out of nowhere for me was that I'm not a nun. And it's sort of like the movie has, you know, you have to put yourself in the nun's shoes to understand why things fall apart the way they do. I understood some stuff. I mean, you know, certainly like the fact that Sabu knocks up Gene Simmons and they have to leave is a big problem, and it would be a big problem to the nuns, because Sabu wanted to start coming to the convent to learn the same history and different languages and school lessons and stuff that they're giving for free to these children. But the reason they have the rule that there can't be full-grown men there is precisely because of what happens. He ends up knocking up the bad girl who they've taken in. She got her claws on him. And there's these scenes where he's, you know, having his school lessons and Gene Simmons is sneaking peeks at him. So they failed in that regard. And that's, you know, that's a big downer for them. So
it's good for Gene Simmons, though. I mean, her character is
she marries up.
Her character is,
she's not an untouchable anymore.
She, I think she gets a lot of, sympathy when the old lady is beating the crap out of her
for stealing some jewelry, and then Sabu shows up and the old lady tells him to pick up the beating, and instead he gives her a necklace.
Yeah, so I mean, and that the whole Sabu thing is, it's a subplot in a way that you don't see a subplot. Because it's a subplot that's introduced over halfway in.
It's sort of like a two-part subplot. The first part has to be Gene Simmons being brought in, and then like it doesn't get followed up on until like about a half an hour later when Sabu is introduced for the first time, and then shortly afterwards the two of them run off.
Yeah, and I mean it's kind of like we always are talking about the difference. I think we. mentioned this with Kurosawa, how different the movies being made in other countries are at this time than the ones being made in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just yet another example of that.
Yeah. And I mean, it's old style filmmaking to be able to have those kinds of smaller roles for character actors who can actually, you know, bring a lot of presence to them. And you don't see plum roles for character actors anymore. We don't really have character actors in American movies anymore because we don't have the kind of, you know.
What about John Turturro in Transformers?
We don't have the kind of well-written subplots that can, you know, contribute to the larger story anymore.
And the other thing I was thinking of, though, we were just talking about how you're saying, you know, you're not a nun, so the gravity of all these little things. We're watching this on DVD or video, something. Just imagine what it must have been like on a 40-foot high screen at the time. So maybe...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Just maybe some of the zonking out based on the scenery that we can't really appreciate the grandeur of it because... you know, you can respect it and you can be impressed by it, but there really isn't grandeur on your...
Yeah, it's not overpowering as it would be on a, you know, giant movie screen.
So I think that could be some of it.
A bit like seeing The Shining on a big movie screen. huge, or any Kubrick movie, really. Getting those huge vistas in a movie, in a story where the... It calls for, you know, creating a feeling of isolation visually and through direction.
And so,
I was thinking about the when you said that the shot of the bell by the cliff outside the convent that it keeps coming back to, where Deborah Carr rings the bell in the morning, and it's you know, I had seen a clip from this movie too, and unfortunately, it was the very end where this was a long time ago, so I didn't even remember until I was watching it. But it's at the very end where Kathleen Byron shows up like a bat out of hell and attempts to push Deborah Carr off the side. And it made me think like is this movie going to be almost like Psycho 2, where there's someone running around the convent and they don't know who it is, and then she shows up at the end and attempts to murder. But if I hadn't seen that clip and I hadn't known that some kind of confrontation was coming, I think I might have been able to guess that something intense was going to happen, because they really establish it early on and then keep coming back to it for no apparent reason except to remind you how freaking high up this convent is in the mountains of the Himalayas. And it's so intense. It really creates vertigo, like, just looking at it. So I can only imagine how intense it would be on a big movie screen.
And then
it's like Mount Rushmore in North by Northwest or something. It's like it's really suspenseful when somebody's about to fall off of it, even though it's just a set and there's nothing there.
And that seems like a full-on action scene, which I didn't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's like what was the Hitchcock one on the Statue of Liberty that's really lame, but. That sequence,
Saboteur.
I mean, you know, she's kicking at her and she's pulling her hand. It is a real big action scene. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's extremely suspenseful. Like, Kathleen Byron is even like creeping up on her and, you know, getting closer. You can just hear the people in the audience around you screaming, "Turn around, turn around."
And it is a scary place. And I mean, that's kind of the funny thing about it is that until that point, just based on the sort of sunlight, the daybreak lighting of it, it's windy all the time, which they actually don't play up as far as they could get blown off the side of the cliff, which I think, that's never really a concern, but it's just,
there's that There's that one shot where Dave Farrar and Deborah Kerr are like just casually talking, and they're like right on the edge
Yeah.
of the. And I'm like, God, why don't you? You're so used to it that that doesn't bother you. Like one slip, and you would be plummeting hundreds of feet.
And then the ending's kind of weird because it's quiet too. I mean, there's
Yeah.
more talking about Sabu and Gene Simmons than there is about what happened
Right.
with the nuns. Like,
Right. All that happens is Deborah Kerr asks Dave Farrar to tend to her grave in the future.
and it's just
It's
it's
kind of a nice resolution. I mean, it's maybe a little unrealistically happy, but basically Deborah Kerr and Dave Farrar have this, moment of understanding. They clasp each other's hands together, and it's like, well, so long. At least it didn't work out, but at least we're parting on good terms here.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think, 46. I mean, yeah.
What are you thinking about?
Well, just, compared to an American movie, is there any chance? I don't think in an American movie you could have had almost anything he said in the movie.
Making fun of Jesus and whatnot.
Making fun of Jesus, but also the fact that he was basically putting the moves on a couple nun, implying that he was gonna, put the moves on a couple nuns. I mean, it's just like, and then, of course, this played in the U.S. This was a,
Oh,
the.
and the Catholic Legion of Decency lobbied successfully and got the pre-nun scenes of Deborah Kerr removed, which I thought was interesting. I mean, as if that's the most objectionable thing for staunch Catholics, just the acknowledgement that Deborah Kerr's character had a life before she was a nun. I mean,
Yeah.
so they're sort of and it's odd because like Deborah Kerr even alludes to how, she has leftover mixed feelings from not being a nun. So it's not even like cutting those flashback scenes out removes that aspect of her character. But I actually thought like those it's weird because I mean they pick she starts flashing back like about midway through the movie, and the flashbacks show these different periods times in her life when she was almost going to get married to this guy, and instead of seeing what happened to them, she just says what happened to them, that he ended up going to America and working for his uncle or something rather than getting married to her. So, but I thought it was going to lead up to the dramatic flashback where she's crying and it's like don't go, and then I don't know, she sees a cross flies through the window when she's in her study late at night and she says, "Yes, Father, I shall become a nun."
But instead, it's really quiet and it's off screen, kind of like half the stuff in the movie. And the stuff we're left with is sort of this rising tension at times. That scene where the little kid, the adorable little translator kid, brings Sister Ruth a glass of milk. I mean,
Yeah, I
I
forgot
kept
about that.
going.
What the hell was that
I
about?
kept going. Does she kill him? I can't remember. Is that how she goes nuts? She kills the little kid. I mean, like, seriously, you could see her killing a little kid, and it's just that's at least.
She gets brought a glass of milk and she looks at it like it's poisoned and she dumps it out the window and she's like smiling evilly the whole time. It's really like, what is going on here? People are going nuts.
And so, yeah, it's probably a good first Powell and Pressburger movie,
Oh, good. I'm
I'm
glad.
thinking. It wasn't my first, I think it was my second or third, but it's a good one 'cause
The one I've heard a lot about is Tales of Hoffman, which is also on the Criterion DVD label.
Yeah, Tales of Hoffman's interesting as a... they got really musical-centered in the late 40s.
Yeah.
And it's more like that. It's they tried to film an opera.
Right.
They wanted to do. And so... there are other stuff, though, in the 40s. I've seen The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, which is also in color, I think. And that... I think I saw that right before Black Narcissus. And Deborah Kerr is in that, too. And that's a really, really good one. Yeah, that's the long one. That's like almost 3 hours. But then I Know Where I'm Going is this really sort of... not mellow, but it's kind of like if you were going to make a romantic it's like The Shop Around the Corner only made by British people type romantic comedy. I mean, it's cute, it's got all this stuff going on, but then there's also the Powell and Pressburger sort of this strange depth in terms of how people, you know, sort of exist in setting, which is definitely in this. And then I actually, you know what? I think the first Powell movie I actually ever saw was Peeping Tom, which is awesome.
Yeah, and it's probably its most famous.
Yeah, I mean, it's just awesome. And then I went back and saw some of their older stuff. But, I mean, Peeping Tom is just, you got to see it. I hope it's on Netflix so you can check it out. It's just awesome.
Do we have much time left?
I think we ran over a little.
There's just two things I wanted to mention. One is that what we were talking about, what they would do differently. I think when they remake Black Narcissus, and I'm saying when, not if, because everything's getting remade these days, Deborah Kerr and Dave Farrar's characters are definitely going to sleep together, and as they did not in Black Narcissus. And the other thing is... I was amazed. I was watching this movie and I was thinking, like, well, this is, you know, this is still clearly British India, and British India get split into Bangladesh and India in World War II, or Pakistan rather, not Bangladesh. And I was amazed to find out, like, there's a real kind of beautiful synchronicity in that. This movie came out just a few months before that happened, and the last scene of Black Narcissus is the British nuns leaving India, and the Indian summer rain coming down, you know, the storm season. So it's really just kind of a, you know, one of those coincidences you can't plan on, but historically it's the perfect accidental visualization of what was happening for real.
Now,
I used too many words to describe that, but I just thought it was cool.
For the remake, I am going to propose Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt as a Weinstein comeback. Maybe Quentin Tarantino can direct it. Huh? Rose Byrne can be Sister Ruth. And there you go.
There's
your movie.
Seth Rogen in his Tarantino star-making role, or serious actor-making role as the old general in Indian person makeup. Because, you know, if Robert Downey Jr. can play a black guy...
Very true.
Certainly we can have, like, yeah, I know American culture is warming up to Indian culture right now, but, you know, surely we can put some white guys in Indian makeup again.
Okay. Now, moving on to something else.
Now for something completely different. Where to begin? Cobra is... everybody makes fun of 80s action movies and 80s action movie cliches. And it's interesting to try to find out where they started. Cobra, I'd never seen this before, and it's really where a lot of these... I don't know if it's where they started, but it really embodies a lot of them. A number one, you've got the opening action scene being the titular badass main character showing up at a crime scene and being like, okay, what's the situation? And it's a hostage situation in a grocery store. And he goes in, he acts very glibly. He tosses off one-liners. He blithely blows away a ethnic minority who's, you know, taking the place hostage. And well, I don't know. If nothing else, just the way it opens up. Oh, I guess the other big cliche that I think of as synonymous with cheesy 80s action movies is that there's a cop or a detective or whatever on the force who's a whiny liberal who's always going on about, you know, the rights of people. Oh, and the media is also giving him a hard time about, you know.
Yeah, right. That was really funny at the beginning when they're...
And, yeah, and he pulls back the cloth of the body on the stretcher and goes, you know, tell that to his family.
What's really funny about that first scene is that the psychotic gunman goes into a grocery store,
mm-hmm.
shoots it up, and then takes hostages. Oh, wait, hold on. He's actually part of the New World Order, right?
Yeah, that's a big thing to get into.
Yeah, okay, so, but I don't want to get into it yet, because that's, uh-huh. that actually really confused me for a while. But, he doesn't kill anybody till he's like, you can go, man, you can go, run, get out of here. And then he shoots the guy in the back. Like, right. He could have been walking around the store shooting tons of people. But for some reason, he waits until the guy runs away.
Until the most evil possible moment to kill somebody. Yeah.
Okay, so let's see if we can synopsize Cobra.
Well, I was kind of, we should just, you know, get into the cult thing. The main thrust of the plot is that there is a secret society whose aims are really, or even more secret. the only description we get from any of them comes at the very end, where the leader or one of the leaders is confronting Stallone, and he says that the secret society is out to create a new world by killing off the weak. Some kind of Darwinian secret society, but that's really like the most explanation we get. It's kind of brilliant the way there's no explanation for who they are, or where they came from, or anything. But I was shocked to find out that the novel that this is based on wasn't about that. It was about Soviets, like a secret enclave of Soviet spies, it's the same thing happens to Bridget Nielsen, who's the Stallone's girlfriend at the time in real life, and the woman who gets targeted by this cult and who Stallone has to protect. The name of the novel is Fair Game. So, like, I thought, like, okay, that must be about, you know, the novel must also be about the cult with a name like that, Fair Game, implying that, like, you know, you've got this evil cult who's hunting humans, basically. But no, that was created by Stallone. I was flabbergasted.
Now, you know, of course, what Fair Game became, right?
Oh, right. They made it in the 90s again as an action.
Cindy Crawford. It was the Cindy Crawford movie.
Huh. Right. That didn't have the cult that was actually based on the novel.
Okay, this is just strange, but Steven Berkoff was in it, the remake, and Steven Berkoff was in Beverly Hills Cop, and Cobra, the script of Cobra, is Stallone's script for Beverly Hills Cop when he was going to be in it.
Yeah, apparently when Stallone, in the 80s, when Stallone came into a movie, like, he had to completely rewrite the story, and he wasn't going to do it otherwise. I mean, you know, I'm sure, like, Rambo was mostly him and not James Cameron.
But, well, yeah, Cameron always talks about that. But anyway, so what's stupid about... Hold on.
What's stupid about Cobra?
I'm sorry. There is a couple interesting things just in terms of casting that I can't see that anybody's ever mentioned. So The bad guy, or the panty-waist liberal cop in this movie, is played by Andrew Robinson, who is the father from Hellraiser. But he is also, he was the
Scorpio killer
from Dirty Harry. Rene Santini, who plays Cobra's partner, is the partner from Dirty Harry. This is kind of like, you know, Stallone's Dirty Harry movie, which...
Yeah.
Right,
and it's, you know, I guess it's kind of clever irony to cast Andrew Robinson as, you know, the non-psychotic Scorpio killer version of the guy who's saying, you know, I got rights, it was Callahan, you know?
And it's just... So, but I kept expecting him to be the leader of the New World Order, because they never, even though they kept talking about, was it the Night Slasher?
Uh-huh. That's the name of the leader.
That's the name of the leader. It was never clear to me that big ugly dude was the Night Slasher.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was the name of the cult at first, like the night slashers, and that guy was just one night slasher among many. But at some point they start talking about the night slasher.
Yeah, and there's like dirty cops and things like that. But then there's
thing about the secret society is that, like, there's one dirty cop. She's a dispatcher who's a cult member. And that's another bizarre thing about an intriguing thing about the cult that's never mentioned is that, like, sometimes we see the cult members, or at the very beginning in a montage of shots, we see the cult members clanging battle axes together in some kind of synchronized order, which is just absurd. But one of them is like a businessman.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not all like goony looking punks and stuff. And the dispatcher, you know, along with that, implies that this secret society has infiltrated all echelons of society, but that's just not followed up on at all.
And then there's this part where the stupid brass who doesn't listen to Cobra, I'm sorry, the Cobra, that's how he's introduced, the
Lieutenant Marion Cobra Cobretti,
the one, you know, the cat. I love the the, you know, ranks in this movie, because I'm like, so there's the lieutenant. Cobra's a lieutenant? Really? Cobra's a lieutenant?
Bad lieutenant, if you will.
I mean, it's kind of like, I think, you know, Hill Street Blues was on at this point. That actually had real... tried not to be goofy with, like, police ranks where, you know, Schwarzenegger's, you know, playing a general of the freaking LAPD or something. And it's like, you'd think they would, Stallone would have seen that and maybe tried to have some realism to it. But it's just like, when I heard him call him Lieutenant Cobretti, I'm like, what, Stallone's like, well, I gotta be a lieutenant at least. I can't be a detective.
Hey! Yeah. It sounds better.
So, anyway, they introduce him as the Cobra. They have to bring in the Cobra.
Yeah, but badass muscle car.
That poor car that gets destroyed.
I know, that was really sad. Although the chase that happens is probably the best directed sequence, like as far as being an action movie goes. But it is, you know, too bad that they decided they could just destroy it at the end.
Yeah, so, did I lose? Oh, right, my train of thought on the whole Night Slasher thing. So the brass, the police brass is telling everybody that there's only one killer.
Right.
Even after Stallone kills two guys who come to his house to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it more than one person.
You know, it's another 80s action movie cliche that I don't know if this movie started, but it definitely kind of perfectly incorporated it in, was, you know, local punks who don't know how tough the main character is messing with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he shows them what's what. It's like he pulls up to his beach condo and like there's these Mexicans and they're low rider and they're not giving him the parking space. So he just rams into their car with his big muscle car and they're like, hey, say, what you doing, Holmes? And like, he just kind of, he doesn't punch him out or anything. He just kind of stares them down. And then he rips the leader's.
Yeah, the guy's shirt.
And that's like scary. It's scary enough that they all back off after that. So that's a great.
Yeah, that was actually pretty fun. I mean, it's just like, this is the height of Stallone being so insanely full of himself that.
Rocky 4 came out in 85 also, right? Along with
I mean, he was the biggest star in the world
I just can't believe like he would do a movie for Golden Globus after like Rocky 4 and Rambo come out the same year, the year before.
You gotta remember that, I mean, the 80s were kind of different. I mean, the blockbuster system, as it was, did not exist. So, I mean, didn't Rocky IV make just hundreds of millions of dollars?
Like, yeah, it was one of the top grossing movies of the year.
Yeah, it made 127. Well, actually, all of them made an obscene amount of money, but.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I mean, it just made a ton of freaking money.
Right. It's the peak of Stallone mania in the 80s.
So that's, he gets to do whatever he wants, but still.
This is what he does.
Only through Golan Globus will give him the money to do it.
Which is perfect. Only Golan Globus. This is one of Golan Globus' greatest achievements.
In some ways, this is one of their most. Kind of is. I mean, a major studio released it. George P. Cosmatos,
the
director of Rambo 2, right? First Blood, yeah. And I mean, he went on to do some stuff. I like Leviathan, for instance. I think that's a pretty well-made movie. And, I mean, and some of the action stuff in this isn't bad. So, I mean, it's kind of their most, whatever. I don't know.
You know, the thing about the story is that, like, number one, I never checked at what point I was at any time, because the whole thing is just so darn entertaining. But the movie ended really abruptly for me, because basically what happens is about halfway through, Bridget Nielsen is targeted by the cult because, like, she, for 2 seconds, drives by the scene of one of their random vicious assaults on, you know, some hapless lady. And, just because she sees them for 2 seconds, they have to mass together all the resources to hunt her down and kill her. So Stallone, like, takes her out into the country eventually after that freeway chase happens in the city. He's like, we got to get you out of the city now. And they go out on the road, and the cult follows them, and there's kind of a shootout, and then eventually they get to what Roger Ebert likes to call the sparks and steam factories that you see in movies, where, you know, it's just some kind of big industrial place where, well, I don't know, I'm sure if I was paying more attention I could see what kind of factory it was, but the point is, like so many movies, the final confrontation happens in a factory, and Stallone has this one-on-one mano-a-mano confrontation with the night slasher. And by that point, I realized the movie was almost over, and I couldn't believe it. I thought, like, I didn't realize that the whole movie was going to hinge on the protection of Bridget Nielsen. I thought that, you know, we were going to find out more about the cult as the movie went on, and that this, you know, this hugely elaborate plot device of this evil cult was going to be the narrative thrust. But no, you don't find out anything about that cult. The narrative thrust is just the protection of Bridget Nielsen in a part that, you know, Stallone knew his girlfriend was born to play. And she's barely recognizable too, because she has her hair like dyed and curly, and it doesn't look like Bridget Nielsen's usual Aryan Hitler Youth look.
Yeah, but, that's kind of weird. She did Beverly Hills Cop 2 after they broke up. But there's this idiotic fashion montage with her in it and robots. And, I mean, if you've seen Rocky IV, I think it's Rocky IV, you know Stallone liked robots.
And montages.
And montages.
And the editor, I don't know if it's necessarily the editor's fault, but I mean, I kind of want to say this movie's got the worst editing I've seen in a long time, but like the freeway chase is well edited. So the editor knew what he was doing. It's just that like Stallone must've been like, put a montage in here. And he's like, what can we use for a montage? He's like, well, I'll just get some coverage of the robots. And you don't know what the hell it is, because Stallone is, you know, like cruising the streets and talking to people with his partner, you know, trying to investigate the random murders that the cult is doing. And then suddenly there's robots and it's extremely confusing. And then you see Bridget Nielsen and other models posing with the robots. And that doesn't help you out either. You're still confused. You still don't know why robots are being intercut with the homeless while this horrible song plays. And then finally, Bridget Nielsen gets attacked by the night slashers, and you're like, oh, okay, that was her introduction. She got introduced in a montage, and that couldn't have been more confusing. Why they were suddenly cutting to robots? It really is remarkable.
Yeah.
It was one of the things that was like described to me by people who had seen this movie when they were saying like you won't be able to believe this movie until you see it. Like there's a montage where they try to compare the robots to homeless people. And I'm like, what? Really? And then I see it and it's like, well, it's not exactly that, but it might as well have been
They have David, what's his name, Rashi in that scene who I don't know if he'd been on Sledgehammer yet or whatever that show was called, but I know him because he sort of...
Is he Bridget Nielsen's photographer?
He's Bridget Nielsen's photographer who gets shot up for a second. Yeah, it looks like Sledgehammer was just coming on at that point, so whatever. But the guy's got sort of a weird credit at the beginning, like, you know, and David Rashi. And I'm like, oh, he's going to be in it? And he's in it for a second, and then he gets killed by the psychos who are out to get her. And then she goes to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I actually didn't think she was going to call the cops after they attack her in the parking lot. I was shocked that that's how Cobra got in this two stories hit. Because I'm like, nah, she's not going to call the cops, not in this script. And so then there's like this, there's this scene where Cobra goes home to go through his files.
Yeah, the pizza scene.
So first he cuts a piece of pizza in half with some scissors.
That was also from the same person. The other thing, like, you gotta see this to believe it.
But then he's got his like bat cave there where he's like, I'm gonna go home and check my files. And so he has like this, like these two TVs that I guess are supposed to be a computer because it like runs through mugshots.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got all those books that he's looking through. And it's just, it's the height of...
Ferris Bueller's room had more credibility, I think.
Yeah. There you go. Perfect. But then you know, there's this whole thing where somebody called him, his partner, to the station to get him away from the hospital, and he thought it was Cobra. And it's, I guess you could think it was the evil female cop, but she doesn't really have a guy's voice. So who made that phone call? That's never explored. We also don't find out what the name of the night slasher is, which I guess makes it kind of like Dirty Harry, in that we never find out the name of Scorpio. I'm
This movie's a lot like Dirty Harry. It is Stallone's version of it.
It opens with this what is he? A murder. Stallone goes through these crime statistics.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's like listing off these statistics about crime and stuff. And
while he plays with his gun.
How many rapes and murders there are per second. And just like the opening of Magnum Force, you have the barrel of a gun take aim at the camera.
And I'm kind of like, and the problem is that he's not fighting a crime wave. He's fighting a bunch of insane cultists.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was surprised about that. I mean, the tagline is a really good one. It's crime is a disease, meet the cure. And then he quotes his own tagline to the guy who's holding up the grocery store. He says, you know, you're a disease and I'm the cure.
Yeah, so it almost would have been more fun if Stallone had stuck with some of these ideas he apparently had. Not mm-hmm. that it would have been any good, but I think it would have been stupider for longer and in funnier ways. Because then there's this huge romance between him and... that is one thing I want to say about it. There are a couple good scenes. Or not good scenes, but there are a couple scenes...
Like when he flirts with her over the french fries?
I was more thinking the one where he tells her his name or something, where she goes up and gives him shit about his name and he has like some funny comeback about it.
Yeah, well, they were a real couple. They had some kind of interplay.
And then the scene in the hospital where he and his partner are fighting over food. I mean, that's just, it's inane, but it was funny. I mean, I was like, that's incredibly stupid, but yeah, it's kind of funny that they're sitting there fighting about it. They're like, wait, are you done with this?
Well, it's kind of like the first Rocky, which Stallone wrote, where like the best scenes are kind of just him talking to ordinary Joes and stuff. And kind of the tragedy of Sylvester Stallone is that he was kind of good and funny at that stuff, but he chose to be an action star instead.
And now he's sort of going through his career resurgence where he realized that he can get, you know...
He can be an action auteur with the upcoming The Expendables.
Well, he can, you know, by sort of... profusely apologizing for his 80s action movies. He can
and his 90s action movies.
He doesn't profusely apologize for those as much. It's like people are willing to forget them for some reason. But I mean, you know, and then Stallone, you know, that's like the funny thing is I like the last two he did. I'm looking forward to The Expendables. I think that's an interesting idea, you know?
It's a great gimmick, if nothing else.
And so, I mean, I love Rocky VI, and, you know, Rambo 4 was at least really... Rambo 4 is what the Hurt Locker wishes it could be, in some ways, obviously. But it's just like his, you know, ludicrous 80s career. The movie ends with this song that he clearly got somebody who's supposed to sound like Bruce Springsteen singing some American anthem for him, but it's not.
Yeah.
And instead, you know, it's a,
doesn't it even have like the parenthetical title, like love theme to Cobra?
No, that's another song. The end title song is, I had to look this up. Voice of America's Sons.
Oh yeah,
is the theme from Cobra.
It's not so much like Imitation Springsteen as it is Imitation Huey Lewis. Like the heart of rock and roll is beating all across the USA.
And then Loving on Borrowed Time, I believe, is the right, that's theme.
Right, that's what plays during the montage that begins with the robots, I believe.
So the bums get some love. But I was really disappointed because the music is by Sylvester LeVay, who I really like. He did the music for Touch and Go and Mannequin. And he's, you know, he's a synthesizer 80s guy, and he's fine. There's like no music in this. During the chase scene, there's no music. It's a chase scene with no music in an 80s movie. It's crazy. Like, I don't know what they thought was going to be over it, but instead it's just totally silent, which makes it sort of surreal.
Yeah, because it's like, usually the action movies do that when they want to have a realistic feeling to their car action scene, like Bullet or something, but I mean, this is it's an awesome chase scene, but it's also ridiculous. I mean, like, the muscle car manages to do a 180 and then drive backwards just as fast so Stallone can fire out the window and then do another 180 to right itself. So.
Yeah, and then the zombie squad.
We got a
couple minutes to talk about that. It's never explained what the zombie squad is.
Isn't it self-explanatory?
No! Does that mean they only work at night? What does that mean?
It means they only deal with zombie-like cultists.
I think even that panty-waist liberal Andrew Robinson guy would have, if there were mass amounts of cults breaking up in L.A., I think he even would, you know, give Cobra some love, but no. And it's kind of funny at the end, Cobra punches him out.
Right.
Which,
And it doesn't seem to phase him either. It's not even like he hits the floor or anything. And it's not even like he deserved the punch. I mean, God, I mean, I've seen much ruder, you know, police lieutenants and stuff who are trying to get the main character fired because he doesn't play by the rules. I mean, as far as those guys go, Andrew Robinson wasn't really in the top tier.
No, he was like a negotiator too. I mean, it's just like, you know, he's a detective. Oh, wait, hold on. They have the, they got the ranks here. He's a detective who was talking back to his lieutenant. So he was, you know.
I've noticed that.
Yeah. Well, of course, the bad guy can't be a lieutenant with Stallone.
Yeah.
Come on.
But I liked how Sylvester, when he punches him, it you know, he just kind of takes it in stride because it's almost like it's implied that Cobra held back or something.
Well, he would have had to, man.
Because if he really wanted to, he could have knocked his head off.
Hey, it's Cobra.
Right.
And then, so the action scene, besides the good car chase, the big shootout is in an old motor court.
Right out in the desert somewhere where they've brought Bridget Nielsen, but because of the corrupt dispatcher, all the cultists have followed him there.
So it's so exciting that you basically have, it's one of those motor courts where you have individual bungalows and there's sort of a drive circling through it. And so that's where the huge action scene is, where he's shooting people off motorcycles and, you know, it's Cobra versus 50 guys, and it's right. Just like,
about it.
At least in Rambo, in First Blood, there was like some stealth involved. Like, he stopped for a second, was like, well, he can't kill all the guys at once.
Yeah, this is a bit like Commando, where Schwarzenegger takes on an entire island at the end.
Yeah, so
Commando, of course, had already come out, so I guess they knew that was the new normal.
And then they ride off at the end into the sunset on a stolen motorcycle.
Yeah.
Having
defeated the entire cult by killing the Night Slasher.
Well, he also killed all the other guys before that, though.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was supposed to imply that, like, every single member of the cult had shown up at that big shootout.
I think so.
So they're all dead now, so.
You only saw one of the snipers get killed, and I thought they set up, like, six snipers at some point, but Art LaFleur is in it, and Art LaFleur was in Trancers. I like him. Then some other stuff. He was the captain who, whatever, knows that Cobra's got the right method, even though nobody else knows it. I don't know. Brigitte Nielsen eating French fries and being a supermodel was kind of weird, I thought.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I think they mention it.
Do they? Okay.
It's like, I don't know, maybe she gets around it by not putting too much ketchup on her fries, and that's why it's That's why it's funny that Stallone is piling on the ketchup. Maybe.
Yeah. So
I like the extreme violence in the final fight between Stallone and the Night Slasher, where he punches him onto a hook, and then he gets carried on a hook, you know, yelling and screaming into a wall of flames. And they don't linger on the flames, but it's pretty horrible. Stallone basically acts like Leatherface putting someone on a hook and watching him squirm.
He did mess up that awesome car.
Oh, right. No, that was a more heinous crime for sure. Yeah,
definitely.
I also liked how his character's trademark of carrying a match in his teeth like it's a toothpick pays off eventually when he lights it and flicks it on a trail of gasoline and explodes something.
I wasn't waiting for that from the first second it showed up. Let me tell you, that was a big shock.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's important to set up that your character has a... I wonder if, like, he got to the point in the script where that needed to happen, and he was like, how can I set up that this character is going to have a flame source? And it's like, well, he could either be a smoker, or he could carry a match in his teeth through the whole movie.
Yeah, until
it comes in handy.
I think I made a crack at some point that Stallone probably wrote this in about 3 days, and apparently he wrote Rocky in 3 days, so
I'm willing to bet that a lot of the interplay on the streets of Philly was more improvisational than it was than any of the interplay was in Cobra, the casual sounding interplay in Cobra.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else really. I don't think so. I don't really have anything.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he does have that really cool gun. We can't forget about the cool gun.
Yeah, right.
With the laser sight.
Yeah, he's holding it on the poster, which is, now that I think about it, a complete rip of the poster for the first Terminator, where he's even, like, he's holding his gun the exact same way Schwarzenegger holds his, laser sighted pistol.
And
only it's not a pistol, it's some kind of automatic weapon.
I did want to also give him some credit for sort of hopping on that awesome sunglasses are cool thing. Because yeah. I actually thought the Top Gun started that in the 80s. I didn't realize it was Cobra.
The reflective sunglasses, yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, it's a good look. I mean, you know, he's
tough. I thought
his character's voice was going to be a lot more gravelly than it was, because it's really gravelly when he's spouting off the statistics at the beginning. Like it almost sounds like he does in he sounds now in Rambo, but it's not too bad.
No.
But anyway, I mean, you know, you look at the poster, you see Stallone with is the match in his teeth in the poster? But he's got the gun, he's got the sunglasses, and
I think he's got the match in his mouth. He does!
The movie's called Cobra, and you just, like, yeah, what you see is what you get. Only, actually it's not, because, I mean, wow. The cult plot is really what puts the movie over the top. The fact that it's so elaborate and so inexplicable, and that every now and then you see all the cult members banging axes together, and it was hilarious how that was their only allowed method, seemingly, of killing their innocent victims for a while, is that you got to do it with axes if you want to be in on it. You gotta walk up to a lady's car and just start hacking it to death like it's Mad Max or something.
Yeah, and we kind of lost that, which was too bad.
Right.
Yeah.
But, this movie's just begging for a sequel to go into the, well, actually, no, they couldn't go into the details of the cult, because Stallone killed them all.
Yeah, I actually think they ought to remake it with Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy isn't allowed to do those kinds of movies anymore, if he was ever.
But it'd be funny, because it's like the original Beverly Hills Cop script. Huh? Huh? Actually, no, I mean, seriously, I think this is something Stallone probably could revisit today with some, you know, some success, possibly.
Yeah, people don't really remember it as one of his iconic roles, even though it's should be remembered as one of his iconic roles.
I think it's remembered as an absurdly awful 80s movie to some degree.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, this movie does get its due as one of the most hilariously cheesy action movies of the 80s, and that's a reputation that's well-deserved.
Yeah, it's...
I think the tagline was even... Was one of the taglines, for this movie, Rambo, Rocky, and now Cobra?
No, let me look real quick.
It must have not, like, the voiceover in one of the trailers. I'm probably thinking of The Adventures of Ford Fairlane, and it's one of its taglines of, like, you know, Rock or Rambo, Schwarzenegger, wimps. Ford Fairlane.
Yeah, I can't find that, but you know, Stallone did like doing sequels, so it's wow. The Japanese photo poster is, or the Pakistani photo poster is awesome.
What is it?
It's Stallone with the gun, but no sunglasses. His gloves on. The night slashes on one side. There's an Asian girl in the bottom corner who's not in the movie. Three pictures of Brigitte Nielsen, and then a picture of them on the motorcycle, and then, like, an upside-down car.
Nice.
So, yes. And unfortunately, ooh, you can even download a high-resolution copy of it on movieposterdatabase.com.
Is that Infowars.com?
No, it's not. Apparently, you have to... I've never seen this site before, but you have to have credits or something. I don't know how you get credits. I can't believe they charge... Whatever. I don't know, but... The Asian girl in the bottom corner is hilarious. Because right above her is multiple pictures of Brigitte Nielsen. With different hair. And then the Night Slasher. The Night Slasher was actually in The Terminator, I guess. The guy, he was one of the punks at the beginning.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Hmm. Amazing how you don't remember anybody but Bill Paxton.
He gets all the good lines.
But no role in Avatar, baby. He could have done Avatar. Okay, so Cobra, I think we're done, right?
Yeah, it's it kind of defies description on some level. It's a real must see for fans of bad movies, period. Because it's just hilarious. It's truly, truly hilarious. You won't regret it.
In that way that all going canon films are.
Yeah, but this one's got Stallone.
Okay, so next week we have...
we are doing...
another Academy Award winner. Stallone is an Academy Award winner, and next week we will be talking about an early film from Academy Award winner, Sandra Bullock.
Ah, yes. We're doing The Net, we're celebrating the lifetime achievement of Sandra Bullock. She finally won her best actress Oscar, and we're going to see one of those movies that made her a star. This was 95. It's a scary internet movie. I don't really know much about it except that the internet is out to kill Sandra Bullock, and that sounds pretty good. And it was made in 95, so whoever wrote it probably had no idea what the hell the internet was. So looking forward to that. And our good movie also came out in 95. It's Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man, starring Johnny Depp.
And a lot of other people. Yes, that's going to be... That's a good movie.
Yeah, so...
There's no internet in that either.
In 1995, there barely was.
Wow, and it's The Net. I wonder if the... Yeah, I haven't seen it in so long. I just can't wait.
Dennis Miller is in it, providing 90s sarcastic pop culture references.
And Jeremy Northam's in it, too, who was in Gosford Park that we watched last week. Yeah. So.
That about do it?
I think so.
Okay, well. We will see you next time, and check out AlanSmithyPodcast.info for past episodes. And I guess that's it. So for an Alan Smithy Podcast, this has been Matt.
And I've been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.